And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being the land of opportunity, and maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing is anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Broadcasting from WCAA, The Voice. This is Dan Platt. This is the Three Left Show. I'm currently live streaming. If you go to Facebook page, Three Left Show on Facebook, I'm live streaming. See how it picks up the audio. Otherwise, you can listen to this show online via any podcast app you may have, or going to threelefts.news. where all episodes are archived. I'm at, this will be 43. And with that, theme of the show, I'm going to go through two subjects this week. The first will be more focused on far left activism of a sort. First, kind of making the case for ultra left politics, which is totally not mainstream. I'm going to admit that. Right off the bat, the ideas I'm going to be pitching are generally considered to be uncouth, fanciful, and whatever adjective is used, naive. I think naive is usually a term thrown around. I think it's naive to think that we can still have market economics that where everyone acts morally or it's regulated enough. I went through that last week a little bit, that we can't re-regulate our economy. It's not going to happen. Like, it could happen 80 years ago, but it's not going to happen again. We need to change what our strategy is. I think Elizabeth Warren is on the right track a little bit when she talks about the kind of reforms, you like a little more worker control, a little worker power. It's still really little. It's what Germany has. But Germany isn't quite the egalitarian paradise, especially since their wealth, as ours is dependent on the exploitation, the suffering of people around the world. The factory workers of China, the miners of Africa, some of them children, digging up the minerals for your phones. There's no ethical consumption over capitalism. If we want to be ethical and have some kind of high ground, then you either need to be completely removed from it, very difficult, and if you do succeed in that, which some do, then you're completely removed and no one knows who you are and what you did. So, and I try to have a middle path where I kind of cut down my consumption as much as possible, my unethical consumption. So, how to go forward with this? So, I have a story in front of me. I've collected a bunch, and it's from Socialism Simplified. I think I used an article from them before. Realized Solutions for the Decaying Capitalist Society. But this isn't so much, this is about the past. I'm going to start with the past and move our way to present. The abstract, the historical, the removed from our daily lives, and try to get forward to, and I'll end with people who are trying to actually organize these grassroots community projects that they're doing into something that's scalable, something a little more unified. Because I said, socialism's rising, but what does that mean? I mean, is it really just like more people campaigning for Congress people like Ocasio-Cortez in special elections and special districts? Because, yeah, that doesn't exactly fly in the heartland or rural areas. There really needs to be a complete sea change. And that depends on people changing their minds based on changing material conditions, as it's called. So the more lefties you have doing community projects on the ground, and then the people who didn't like sharing before and, you know, believe in bootstrap theory, maybe they change their mind, you know. And this is with the atheist community too. Like, well, the more we're out there doing nice things, we break the stereotypes that we're not nice and that we only think about ourselves and we're all nihilists, blah, blah, blah. So in part of that, it's about some historical figures you may know who were, in fact, at the time, pro-Soviet Union, pro-Stalin even. And this is just kind of to break the spell, so to speak, that everything about Soviet Union or socialist states of the 20th century, okay, I'm talking about a specific time and place, doing specific things that were, like, if you asked a peasant in Russia, their lives did get better, okay? And it's just assumed everyone's lives got worse, and the only reason there wasn't a revolt right away or there wasn't outrage is because I guess everyone is at heart a sheep and a good little citizen. Well, obviously, if there was a revolution, it means that a lot of people were being disobedient. They weren't going to follow the established order just because they said they were in charge. Everyone isn't like America. But, of course, Americans used to be like that, too. We had quite a lot of rebellions, too. Not defending Stalin, not defending everything socialist leaders in the 20th century, or even today, do. But simply just trying to break some of those old narratives, because I think to talk about socialism or just left politics, honestly, I think we need to get rid of some of the big lies that our teachers told us, so to speak, so that then we can kind of start from zero or just be a little more open and honest about the conversations that we as a society can have. Because as far as mainstream media is concerned, we're always starting at a position that socialism is evil equals genocide equals dictatorship, when that is not the case, especially when it comes to leftist and socialist movements today. This is Einstein and Wells, particularly H.G. Wells, so focusing on these two. I'm going to start reading. So in the February 2017 poll by the propagandic organization Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, which is, billionaire funded or something like that, it was revealed that nearly 1 in 5 American millennials considered Stalin or Kim Jong-un heroes. The credibility of anything published by this deplorable organization is questionable, but there is no denying that there is a rising interest, okay, not admiration, but interest in both communism and Stalin, and for good reason. In this article, I share what some of the leading figures and political activists of the 20th century thought about Stalin himself. Einstein, H.G. Wells, Nelson Mandela, W.E.B. Du Bois, Che Guevara, and Paul Robinson. I also share resources that will help in learning more about one of great socialist revolutionaries and in shedding misconceptions. This guy is a Stalin lover. I'm going to come at this with a skeptical eye because obviously you are very skeptical of anything I'm going to be saying right now. First, Einstein on Stalin. Now, little known fact, Einstein was a socialist. There were many people in the first half of the 20th century who were out proud socialists. All right. It isn't broadcast quite a lot now because something happened in the 50s that is kind of standard knowledge. It's called the McCarthy era. It's kind of, in the textbooks, it's like 2 years. That's what it feels like reading the textbooks. But it was really like a 30-year campaign to drive anyone who would say they were a socialist in the closet. Because if you didn't, you were fired, sometimes jailed, and in some cases, if you were really active, killed. So this is probably the best example of how our education has failed us. We all grew up learning about Einstein and his theory of relativity in school, but most of us were never taught that Einstein was so much more than just a scientist. Einstein was a radical, a staunch supporter of socialism and the black communists in the U.S. He publicly and fiercely criticized British and American imperialism and also strongly opposed Zionism. He was Jewish as well, or half-Jewish. Einstein was also a supporter of the Soviet Union and thought very highly of Lenin. While these aspects of Einstein's activism have been carefully removed from our formal education, what has been suppressed even further is that Einstein supported Stalin. 1937 and 38 letter to his fellow German Nobel-winning physicist Max Born, Einstein wrote, "By the way, there is an increasing sign that the Russian trials are not faked." And so he's referring to the, you know, show trials of the purges, Stalin's purges, which is where there was kind of a big split. You know, you had all these socialist movements, and there was a big question, like, okay, it seems the Soviet Union is doing bad things. Do we still support them? Do we still consider this to be the premier project of, like, where we want to be? And the 30-year McCarthyist campaign was a discrediting that we're going to say, based on yellow journalism, as of now, that they're the bad place with the bad people. And if you're for that or agree with it in any way, then you're the bad people too. And we're going to put a stop to you. That's the big lie. And it's what's happening with Venezuela now. It's what happens with basically any leftism. You know, you're anti-war, you must be with the terrorists. We've lived with that my entire life, and I think all of our lives. I was firmly convinced to begin with that it was the case of a dictator's despotic acts based on lies and deception, but this was a delusion, writes Einstein. Max Born commented in his letter saying, "The Russian trials were Stalin's purges with which he attempted to consolidate his power. Like most people in the West, I believed these show trials to be the arbitrary acts of a cruel dictator." Einstein was apparently of a different opinion. He believed that when threatened by Hitler, the Russians had no choice but to destroy as many of their enemies within their own camp as possible, those that wanted to negotiate with Hitler. I find it hard to reconcile this point of view with Einstein's gentle humanitarian disposition. This is Max Born writing. Now the writer. Even though it seems that Max Born did not align with Einstein on his views regarding Stalin, Einstein continued to support him, Stalin, and the USSR, primarily because of Stalin's efforts to protect the Jews between the two world wars. Stalin's policies welcomed Jews into the Soviet Union, created a safe space for them at a time when they were being ruthlessly persecuted. True story, it wasn't well supported by the state, materially speaking, like it wasn't well funded, but the Soviet Union did create an area, like its own Zionist project, but instead of Israel, it was an area in Siberia, you know, so it wasn't the best land. It was kind of like sending people to Oklahoma or something, but otherwise it was like, okay, we'll put all the Jews here so that, like, there's separation if they so want it, to solve their Jewish question, as it were, because there was still a lot of anti-Semitism, and that was built up over centuries, and that was something that the Soviet leadership really couldn't do anything about. Maybe some of them were even had those views. Soviet Union was also the first non-black nation that gave equal rights to blacks. Read more about it there, and there's a link. So here's H.G. Wells on Stalin. So Einstein was talking and writing about this from afar. He was in America at the time, you know, fleeing Nazi Germany and in the anti-Semitism of Europe, where there was plenty of it in America as well at the time. So yeah, you could say, like, socialists like Einstein were mistaken. You know, they were misled. They were deluded. How could they believe that it wasn't all bad? I just gave you a justification. Kind of justification that many people say, oh, we need to take out the bad guys. In their case, with the Soviet Union, the bad guys were definitely the bad guys, the Nazis. So the reluctance of H.G. Wells. Okay, so now I'm talking about, what is H.G. Wells? Sci-fi writer of War of the Worlds, The Time Machine, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Oh, wait, no, and The Invisible Man. He had also written extensively on human rights. In his 1940 piece titled The Rights of Man, was used as a foundation by the UN for their 1948 Declaration of Human Rights. In 1934, Wells had interviewed Stalin and even thought he found Stalin rather orthodox and unoriginal in his Marxist ideology. He wrote the below about Stalin in his autobiography, quoting Wells. "I have never met a man more candid, fair, and honest, and to these qualities it is, and to nothing occult and sinister, that he owes his tremendous, undisputed ascendancy in Russia. I had thought before I saw him that it might have been that he was because men were afraid of him. But I realized that he owes his position to the fact that no one is afraid of him, and everybody trusts him. I confess that I approached Stalin with a certain amount of suspicion and prejudice. A picture that had been built up in my mind of the very reserved and self-centered fanatic. A despot without vices. A jealous monopolizer of power. I'd been inclined to take the part of Trotsky against him. I had formed a very high opinion, perhaps an excessive opinion, of Trotsky's military and administrative abilities. And it seemed to me that Russia, which is in such urgent need of directive capacity at every turn, could not afford to send them into exile. Trotsky's autobiography, and more particularly the second volume, had modified this judgment, but I still expected to meet a ruthless, hard, possibly doctrinaire and self-sufficient man at Moscow, a Georgian Highlander whose spirit had never completely emerged from its native mountain glen. Yet, I had to recognize that under him, Russia was not merely being tyrannized over and held down. It was being governed, and it was getting on. Everything I had heard in favor of the first five-year plan, I had put into a severely skeptical sleeve. And yet, there has remained a growing effect of successful enterprise. I had listened more and more greedily to any first-hand gossip I could hear about both these contrasted men. I had already put a query against my grim anticipation of a sort of Bluebeard at the center of Russian affairs. Indeed, I had not been in reaction against these first preconceptions and wanting to get near to the truth of the matter, I should never have gone again to Moscow. So I find that very interesting. People who actually go and visited the Soviet Union at the time wrote pretty very different things than what the Hearst newspapers were writing. Quite the opposite. Okay, next, Nelson Mandela. Highly respected, recently deceased. We grew up hearing about and revering Nelson Mandela as a peace and civil rights activist. The first line in his Wikipedia introduction even calls him a philanthropist, but does not mention that Mandela, too, was a communist. In his notes on the Liu Xiaoqi book, How to Be a Good Communist, Mandela wrote, "A communist is a member of the Communist Party who understands and accepts the theory and practice of Marxist-Leninism as explained by Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, and who subjects himself to the principle discipline of such party." He also reiterated from Liu Xiaoqi, "Every party member must raise his revolutionary qualities in every respect to the same level as those of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Stalin." Some say that it is impossible to acquire the great qualities of revolutionary geniuses like them, and that it is impossible to raise our own qualities to the same level as theirs. But as long as party members work hard and earnestly, never allow themselves to be isolated, and by the way, a party, to redefine for you guys, is any type of political organization. Okay? It doesn't have to be, quote-unquote, the party. But it's an organization. Like I think of it as a political union, right? You join a union, you pay dues, so that there's a treasury from which staff can be paid and actions can be taken. Some unions will like do charity work and fund high school programs and stuff like that. And parties would do that too, like the first insurance buy-ins and healthcare clinics. You know, they would be funded by unions of various types. And political unions, parties, did the same. Or they used that treasury to run candidates and try to take office. Win office. Earn it. So I'm quoting Mandela there. Basically kind of toting a line of sorts, saying that members of an organization should be disciplined and toe a line. And that was how his movement succeeded. You had a united movement, a political organization that was communist in character. Now, when, you know, there was shenanigans when it finally did take power, and he won, so to speak, ended apartheid, you know. So there's a big gap between winning apartheid and then actually implementing socialist policies, which they're slowly actually starting to do now. You know, any of the hubbub and hair on fire from the right about white landowners being killed or oppressed in South Africa, that's land distribution, because you have a minority, you know, the Afrikaners, the white South Africans who were in charge and oppressive. They still retained a lot of their wealth and stuff. Okay, last, I'll stick with W.D. Du Bois. He was an American sociologist, historian, civil rights activist, a pan-Africanist author, writer, and editor. He also was a close friend of Einstein and Paul Robinson and significantly influenced Einstein's political development. Du Bois fought for the rights of blacks in the U.S., strongly protested against lynching, Jim Crow laws, and firmly believed that capitalism was the primary cause of racism. Before, for historical context, before Martin Luther King, there was Du Bois, okay? And King himself, also out-socialist, he would say so. Du Bois wrote an eulogy to Stalin that was published in the National Guardian in 1953, titled On Stalin. Below is an excerpt from it. Stalin was not a man of conventional learning. He was much more than that. He was a man who thought deeply, read understandingly, and listened to wisdom, no matter whence it came. He was attacked and slandered as few men of power have been, yet he seldom lost his country in balance. Nor did he let attack drive him from his convictions, nor induce him to surrender positions which he knew were correct. As one of the despised minorities of man, he set Russia on the road to conquer race prejudice and make one nation out of its 140 groups without destroying their individuality. I think a lot of people would debate that, and that is something to be debated, but not buried. Yeah, so it's just, you know, it's a eulogy. It's, you know, my grandmother, when I have a great aunt, and she was a card-carrying communist her whole life. Because she wasn't that active as a member or what have you, she didn't seem to need to remove herself or, let's say, sign the paperwork in the 60s that, like, she was never a member of the Communist Party and so on because she wasn't a teacher. And once this was brought up during her funeral, my grandmother said, like, oh, yeah, you know, if you're for equal rights for Negroes, you're a communist. So that's what we were. And I didn't press her on, like, well, why aren't you still, like, in a left-wing party or something like that? And just pretty much, like, by the 60s, she was less political. And she wasn't politically, I mean, she was never politically active, but as far as just identification, that's what she was talking about. So on a theme of kind of tanky rhetoric here, not my actual politics and goals. I want to get that across. But I have another article here. 5 socialist policies to help liberals or moderates understand socialism. Because the language is so confused, mostly thanks to red baiting being that if you talk about left-wing politics, you must want a Soviet dictatorship. And that killed millions and millions of people. So, you know, argument invalid, dunked, over, don't have to listen to you anymore. And there are still many in the media who talk this way. In fact, and that's why red baiting is very popular. It's very easy. You don't actually have to engage with others' ideas and what they're saying. You can just ignore them. And as far as being paid to do that, then it's just a matter of your self-interest. So rational. This piece here that I'm going to, like, kind of read bits of the big ideas behind socialism and to clear up some misconceptions or at least give a better interpretation of socialism and left politics. Socialists have long debated amongst themselves about concrete policies and tactics, but to most liberals who hear the word socialist, an image is conjured of an edgy teen with only vague and poorly defined beliefs and goals. If you're like me, you probably have been beaten over the head with this stereotype almost every time you get into a discussion with a liberal about your political positions. For this reason, I've compiled a list of 5 positions that I feel demonstrate the broader goals of left. Now, he has not included the word revolution or workplace democracy or democratic centralism, which is like Green Party stuff. The goal of this list is to defend the need for sweeping socialist policies and less about explaining the prerequisites, you know, what is needed before you get there. What are the strategies? How are we going to take power? You know, do we use the Democratic Party or do we use the third party or no party? What does socialism mean? policy-wise? Like, what does it mean in principle? Okay? Without anything else about how. Because that's all debatable, and it's all a lot of valid answers to that. But number one, as far as socialist policy, is end acts of imperialism, both foreign and domestic. Imperialism is economic control through finance capital by capitalists. Okay? Because of capitalists' need to endlessly expand in order to avoid stagnation and decay, the domestic capitalists of the U.S. and the imperialist core more broadly were forced to evolve from purely exploiting labor into exploiting whole nations. Imperialists, and by the way, like, when I say exploit, something that you can pop into your head as, like, what does that, like, mean? It's like, you do a bunch of work, you make some value, right? Let's say for your business or your job, you make $5,000 of value. And then you're paid $2,000 in wages. So that's, like, $3,000 basically being taken. Or a lot of it's just going to the pocket of your employer. That's exploitation, because you made the value, but you have no say over how it's spent. There's the manager, there's the employer, stockholders. They're going to decide how much dividend they want. You don't get a say. So exploitation is just about, like, not having a say over the value you make. Simple enough. Now we're doing it to whole nations. Exploitive relationship between oppressed communities. And it uses a lot of jargon, so I want to avoid that. But just a general point that combating imperialism should be a main focus of any socialist in the West, as it is truly the most destructive obstacle to international struggle. It funds fascists and oppresses workers in the global South. It writes the laws that empower police to murder black and brown workers, and it empowers the dictators of other nations. The importance of the struggle against imperialism cannot be overstated. Okay, next is kind of access to basic needs. Okay, big overcompensating welfare state or a big universal income. Though universal income is a market solution, something to point out. It's not something really socialist. It's debatable. It's socialist as far as, like, if you define socialist as it's a policy that cares about social welfare. Very broad. Still take, like, making this assumption that it's a state doing it for the betterment of others. Doesn't really, like, have anything to do with democracy and being able to choose your own destiny and all that. Ask most liberals what they think socialism is, and you'll find an answer with the confidence of Marx himself that is no more load less than a welfare state. Obviously, this is not true. But it is true that Marxist states such as the USSR and China, being the embodiment of the supremacy of workers, offer their working people a more expansive social contract than any other Western country. That is no accident, but with or without the state being under the control of workers, it is important that we struggle for anything that results in a better life for all workers domestically and elsewhere. Every able-bodied person is owed an opportunity to be a productive member of their community through some form of labor. No one deserves to be robbed of that opportunity for an education via being ill, thus need to health care. And these rights are no less than a required prerequisite for everyone to live a life of dignity, regardless of race, gender, creed, or class. While the government doing stuff is in no way a definition of socialism, sorry, Bernie memes, Marxists should never forget that at the heart of every struggle against dominance is a struggle for a better life. Here's number three to kind of understand what socialism can actually be. Okay, not just higher taxes on the rich. Think 100% taxes on the rich. Because it's not really just about higher taxes on the rich. It's about questioning the very foundations of why are they rich. Because they steal value from workers. Okay, so what do you do about it? 100% corporate tax rate. Strip the thieves of their loot. The workers' only means of survival in capitalism is selling their labor. It is time to end private ownership of surplus, okay? Any and all surplus profit that is not used to expand productive capabilities or increase the quality of goods and services should be owned and controlled democratically by people. In a country like the U.S. alone, while the workers are paid less and less in ratio to their productivity. Trillions of dollars in profit is being generated every year based entirely on their blood, sweat, and tears. At a time when the demands for a basic welfare state are met with repulsively disingenuous questioning as to where the money will come from to provide workers with basic dignity, we must never forget that the surplus value generated and claimed as profit by the private sector is the fruit of workers and should be controlled by them. Though the goal of controlling the surplus is only possible after, and then this is where you get into kind of top-down statist socialist stuff, is the assumption, this is, he's making a conclusion here, that this can only happen once workers seize the state, take it over by force or not, or by election. Demanding this tax rate not only strips the bourgeois, you know, middle class, ruling class, of the current defense for their thinly veiled economic warfare against workers in the form of deprivation of basic human needs. You know, evicting people, throwing people off their land, or in the case of like the pipeline, just getting the state to say, you don't want to grant an easement for the pipeline? Okay, well, we'll just say it's for the public good. The court backs us up. We helped elect them. You know, we funded their campaign. Most judges are elected. Sometimes they're not. If they're not, then they're appointed. Who are they appointed by? Governors? Who funds the governor's campaign? Same people. Number four, common ownership of land. Now, this frames it as state ownership of land, okay? Now, I am not, in fact, a statist. I prefer there would not be a state. State defined as the holder of organized violence, okay? And having a monopoly on force, all right? I prefer no one actually have that kind of monopoly. I don't like monopolies. And I prefer we not have to use force. I prefer no one need use force. This isn't really my politics, but as far as describing common ownership, landlords do nothing but exploit workers, as does all large property owners. I'm not talking about a single homeowner here. I'm talking about developers, talking about big landlords. Like the one from the last episode, I talked about a guy who lives in Queens and he owns all this property in Hartford, Connecticut. What's up with that? According to MarketWatch, renters from the U.S. spent just shy of $500 billion in 2017 alone. And every year that amount rises. Not only do landlords extract this money from the working masses, but at a time when people are spending billions annually for what should be human right, shelter, our growing number of workers are deprived of this. The tired liberal talking point popularized by our media that the world is overpopulated is never revealed to be more hyperbolic than when you realize that capitalists occupy huge swaths of land in multiple countries while workers are left without any shelter or land at all. While huge mansions remain empty, more and more people are dying in the streets, and the imperialists are tone-deaf enough to proclaim that the overpopulation of the planet, this minority of leeches, is standing on the majority and proclaiming the planet to be too small for the huddled masses of working people forced to survive off the scraps they drop. The state should strip these capitalists of their means of pillaging. That means the very property itself. The only way to ensure this right remains unmolested is to remove it from the private sector completely. Now, this is the argument for single-payer health care. Remove health insurance from the private sector. And similarly, following the same logic, which is why anyone on the right or center wishes, or anyone who basically profits for their own sake, wishes to block single-payer or any other kind of big welfare state project, is because once you make the case successfully and implement that the private sector does not need to be involved in health insurance, then yes, you can make the case that it doesn't need to be involved in housing. It doesn't need to be involved in food production. It doesn't have to be involved in anything. That is the socialist position, that the private sector doesn't need to exist. And private sector refers to corporate power. It's referring to big business. So all you anti-corporate Republicans out there, listen up. That's what I'm talking about. The only way to stop the bastards is to take away their means of screwing us. Disarm your opponent. It's not about mashing them into a pulp. It's not about sending people to the gallows, the firing squad, the guillotine. It's just about disarming. But, you see, people shriek in horror to take away someone's God-given property, you know, 100 acres, it's like the same as executing them, apparently. Why would people talk like that? You'd think that owning land and having a means of self-sufficiency was, in fact, some kind of prerequisite to happiness or just having a stable life. Funny that. But it's not execution. It is simply disarming one's opponent. Disarming. Right? Same with publicly funding elections. Remove the private sector from our democracy. Can we have a democracy without private interests dominating it? The people who make these arguments are just as fringe as I am, it seems. But yet, there's still the kind of acceptance that there's nothing we can do about it, or like we'd be worse off if we didn't have private interests dominating our politics. Our politicians, rather. Politics is different than just having politicians. Everyone hates the politicians, but no one seems to want to actually organize to disarm the people who corrupt them, or disarm the corrupt politicians. I suppose small government people think that disarming politicians is about shrinking government. Okay. But I think that's socialists and leftists, this is what this article is about, is about you're focusing on the wrong people. Don't focus on politicians, okay? They're the bit players. It's the people funding them. It's the people corrupting. They're the people that need to be disarmed. You disarm government, and then you leave the private sector completely intact to fire you, evict you, and then send a cop to beat you for good measure. And thus we get to the final, most critical part. Not most critical, but the most absurd, let's say, if you're listening from a non-extreme point of view here. But I don't consider any of this extreme. I consider it just the rational or the sensible conclusion from how things really work, the patterns of our society. Number five is abolishing the right to private property. Okay, now this is hard to it's something that people can't really wrap their head around. Now let's go forward with this. If an underfed worker sees an apple at the top of a tree and climbs it, retrieves the apple and climbs down with it, why should he own the bulk of the apple to an overfed owner of the land the tree was planted on? The owner of this land did not plant the tree. The owner of the land did not grow the apple. The owner of the land did not climb the tree. The owner of the land did not retrieve the apple. The owner of the land did not add a thing to any part of the process except for sitting back and expecting to be paid for the labor of others. This is the reason all nations need to immediately abolish the right to that, to private property. This phrase will earn you either a blank, confused stare or the look of death from any liberal. Despite the fact that Marx defined the socialist concept of private property 100 years ago, liberals have yet to understand the definition. Discussions with liberals about abolition of this right to own the fruits of others' labor still regularly degenerates to belligerent accusations of wanting to take everyone's toothbrushes and Xboxes. That issue withstanding, the only way to ensure the value that workers remain under the control of themselves and have freedom, which apparently we care about, is to strip capitalists of their right to own land, buildings, and tools needed for people to complete the labor, their work, to do stuff. There is no argument to be had here. Workers work, owners own. The right to own space and tools needed for a society is a relic of feudalism. That's what it is. It needs to be unequivocally and immediately abolished once and for all. So that's the meta, big, super crazy case for socialism. But it gets down to the very heart of the methodology, the thinking behind me and the show. That this is the very base. We can't keep depending on these old systems, these feudal systems that allured the person holding organized violence at hand is then responsible for the land and everyone on it. All right, that's slavery. Right? If we're going to be free, either everyone needs their own little, if we're going to keep private property, everyone needs to be given a piece of it, assigned a piece of it at birth, you know? Or when you turn 18, like, maybe it's a cash grant. Maybe it's a cash grant of $100,000. Enough to buy a lot or two. Buy the ability to produce, right? Startup capital, as it were. If everyone was given startup capital, once they turn 18, you could go to college with it. You could buy land with it. You could buy equipment so you can fix cars. Whatever you want. Any kind of free enterprise stuff. Right? Would that not be socialist? I think partly it would be. You know, basic income isn't enough because it's a market mechanism. And I guess giving people a big cash grant is also kind of a market mechanism. But hey, that's a compromise I'm willing to make. And what would that mean? You know, would I lose my computer? Well, no. I built it. It's mine. Personal property. Personal is not private property. So enough rambling. I'm going to end the hour.
I got handed an Ayn Rand sandwich straight from the can. It tasted so bland. I asked a lass to pass me a glass of Engels Conditions of the Working Class. Right away they dragged me to the committee to explain my un-American activity. They're gonna see they made a mistake if they'd only let me play my mixtape. I'm not partial to the Marshall or the plutocrats in their beaver hats and the fascists.
Back to the second hour of the Three Left Show, turning your hair blue and blue turtle shelling the 1%. This is your leftist reading hour, leftist magazine program, where I read various articles that interest me as an activist, as a leftist, as a citizen of the world. So from here, I'm going to Reddit, okay? Not a fully fleshed blog article, whatever. It's a Reddit discussion, but it was shared by a YouTuber on my site, threelefts.news. I think I started it, and I need to add to it a list of all the YouTubers I listen slash watch. Very useful stuff. But this is a discussion linked by a certain YouTuber. The title of it is A Modern Mass Line Could Save the World. So again, this is kind of some far left-wing activist rhetoric here. What's a mass line? And this does talk about that. And that's why I want to read it. And it's also addressing issues of activism, being an activist, being a socialist activist, or just being an activist in any way. conservatives and right-wingers also have a mass line of sorts. No, they don't. Sorry. Tell you why. Okay, there is no question that the capitalist system is collapsing under the gravity of its constant failures. That isn't obvious to you yet. Undergoing assumption. Capitalist system is collapsing. Trump and right-wing populism is a reaction to it. The world economy is entering into its final death spiral, and it's going to take us all down along with it if we don't act soon. Capitalists are more interested in selling you fashionable gas masks and inland property as a way to deal with climate change, rather than concerning themselves with the reality that their outrageous practices have a set timer of 11 years before we reach irreversible destruction. So I'm sure you agree, we need to do something. Before we all panic, but there is a solution that has been used to liberate countries in similar situations around the world. The solution is known as a mass line. Okay, now what is that? The term has nothing to do with holding hands across the world and standing in a line, I promise. A mass line is the primary Marxist method of revolutionary leadership. It is used to describe a process of investigating conditions of local people, learning about and participating in their struggles, gathering ideas, and creating a plan of action, a line, a platform, an agenda, based on the ideas and concerns that people have. So this is still kind of top-down thinking. I don't really like it that much. And maybe I'm not doing it effectively myself, because basically it's the advice of like, go into a community that isn't yours and then learn about it and make your platform from the concerns. And basically every politician does this. So it's almost like saying a socialist politician, like how to operate. But instead of going to donors and the rich and people who fund your campaign and asking for their input, you actually go to the union hall, you go into workplaces and or the local barbershop and talk to people there. So how do we get a mass perspective? We focus on sparking action, not just raising awareness, and concentrate on achieving specific results, so community projects, meeting people's basic needs. In practice, this means doing some legwork. You can organize a lot of people online, but ultimately a physical interaction with someone will leave a lasting impression and motivate them to take action in real life. Like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez going door-to-door to convince her constituents to vote for her with limited resources and money, you will convince your community to stand up for their rights. Get involved with local socialist, communist, or anarchist groups in your area and build solidarity. Together, go door-to-door, talk with regular people. Now, of course, if any of those labels don't fit you, then it simply refers to the like-minded, okay? We must build bridges with all working people if this is going to succeed. That means talking to liberals and conservatives in a non-confrontational way. Socialist messages are popular with all people if you don't call it socialism. I'm kind of giving away the... I'm giving away the secret. We are not here to make these people socialists, we're here to give the masses the tools they need to fix the system. So it's more about community empowerment. Not so authoritarian, then. Remember, you will always have pushback, but do not be encouraged. Gatekeepers are everywhere. Find a way around them. It is also important to note that learning how to convince someone to your position is easier than you think. You just have to know proper tactics. This requires some work, but this link should get you started. Give the YouTube link. How will we achieve a mass line in real life? Here's an example. A GM plant is closing its doors and looking to cripple the local economy. One would organize a small group of dedicated leftists to go door to door and discuss with people how this will affect their community. The group can help guide them to a socialist solution that will fix their problems, such as a worker co-op. Explain to them that worker-owned co-ops would allow workers the vote and keep their jobs, and allow them to make more money in the process. Once enough people are on board with this idea, use the collective strength of all the people you have, you got their contacts or whatever, to push for legislation to be changed directly in that community. The line, so to speak, would be that the government must give the employees a business loan at zero interest to buy the plant and turn it into a worker co-op, similar to the deal given to GM after the Great Recession. There are so many environmental and financial solutions that a mass line can accomplish. This is only one economic example with very specific circumstances. Now, my reaction to this is that the key ingredient is also time. It takes a lot of time to go door to door, especially if you have a job you're holding down yourself. For example, in my area, GM has also, not GM, but GE, different general mega corporation, has also closed plants in my area. And the union there, Electrical Workers Union, did have a line of wanting to buy the machinery there, buy the plant, and bring it under their control. If GE wants to close the plant, fine, move, build a new plant in Florida and exploit workers there, but we want to keep our jobs and we'll find new buyers for the, it was electrical transformers that they made there. But no dice. GE was going to take all the machinery. It was theirs, after all, private property rights, even though it's the workers that use it, and or even built it in the first place. And that's the logic, right? The machinery, right, it's owned by GE, but it was also GE workers, also unionized workers, that made it. So if anything, the union owns it as much as GE does. Now, in this case, there was an appeal to New York State government, Governor Cuomo, to give them such a loan, to buy the plant. And there was a refusal. The executive branch wanted nothing to do with such an idea. Now, last paragraph of this. There is a difference between community outreach and activism. Revolutionaries, radicals, whatever, should generally try to help the masses win with daily struggles. But that is not the main reason for our existence as revolutionaries. Community outreach deals with matters like food banks and soup kitchens, whereas we want to focus on a big picture and the urgency to revolutionize the system as fast as possible. I think another misnomer here, a mischaracterization, and this was brought up by other boomers I know, that revolution means war. Revolution is a battle, it's violence, but the actual definition is simply a large change. But it's simply moving from one status quo to a new status quo. Or you could consider it a shift of levels, like moving something from one shelf to a different shelf. It's on a different level, all right? Doesn't change the character of the object you just moved. That being, like, say, the people. But it also that does. So it is more complicated than that. But I just want to, like, get a picture in your mind. A change that actually changes the dynamic. Because once you change the dynamic, then people can actually change their behavior. I think one example is I was just going through a training, Housing First, because I'm working for a nonprofit that does Housing First. What is Housing First? It's the strategy of harm reduction, that instead of treating homelessness as a behavioral problem, and that people need to fix their behavior before we can give them housing, a right to housing, we give them the housing first. No preconditions or the low bar. Like, even the most wrecked or, like, messed up person, if they can follow the rules that we lay down, anyone can. So we need to make rules that this guy, the guy who everyone downtown knows because he panhandles the most aggressively, always getting arrested, always going to the ER, if we can get rules he can follow, then Housing First can work. From, you have to follow the rules, we're trying to dog train you into being a better person, like you're a child, you're not an adult. People hate that. They don't react well. They don't cooperate, right? Homeless people, what have you. Someone receiving assistance of some kind. But if you give it without preconditions, all right, it's assumed that they're taking advantage. They're not going to learn anything. I'm like, stop treating them like a child. They're not babies. Because once you give someone housing, even if they're a substance, if they have serious substance abuse problems, at least they're doing it more safely. At least they're doing it in a building where there's services there. Someone can help them if they're ODing. If the point is less death, then that's what we need. That's what matters. Providing the basic needs first, unconditionally. And that goes for homes, it goes for healthcare, it goes for education. We put all these barriers saying it's a matter of scarcity that we have to do this. What scarcity? We're the richest in the world. There's trillions of dollars in the banks. Is it all just not there? Is it all not real? Are they admitting that it's all a sham? that none of that money, that this value that's being created by all of our three jobs that we're working, is it all for nothing? Then why are we even doing it? You know, there's a phrase kind of, because I'm watching a program, and let's say you have a radical, and they're kind of pleading their case to someone who's in the system, and like, oh, you're asking me to throw everything I have away, throw it all away to help you. And I'm like, yeah, your system belongs in the garbage. We should throw it all away. If enough people throw it away, or throw parts of it away, then that the trash is where it will be, instead of me, an actual person, being thrown in the trash. So let me finish this up. Our work towards satisfying long-term needs of the masses is even more important than our work in support of immediate and temporary interests. Throughout history, the quote-unquote mass line has been used as a method of direct action to inspire vigorous campaigning and bring about political and social change more quickly. This is a form of activism, not just outreach. It is up each and every one of us to act. If we sit around and wait for the politicians or the social groups to fix this problem for us, we will be underwater in 15 years. Don't make excuses or procrastinate. You are personally needed in this fight. Complacency will sow the seeds of our destruction. So this is like the internal discussion of the far left. It's not all cancel culture and oppression Olympics and the things that liberals were talk about when talking about like left online culture. Sometimes it's stuff like this: how to be more active, how to be active in a better way. So that's why I wanted to read that. So in the last section, I talked about local leftist activism from just from a theory point of view, like how to do it better. Just from a discussion thread on Reddit. And now, a manifestation of that, so to speak, from the Marxist Center. This is a group that wants to organize other ultra-left groups, all really small, like 5 to 10 people at most. Working groups, committees, you know, just a little band of people in each little town. And they want to build a larger organization or an umbrella. And how do they want to do that? They want to build unity. I'll just read it out. Parker McQueenie and Donald Parkinson report back and give suggestions for moving forward after having attended the 2018 Marxist Center Conference, where multiple local socialist organizations aim to unify into a national one. On the final weekend of November 2018, communists from every corner of the continental U.S. shuffled their way to the James Berger Lecture Hall of the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Take part in what was more of a congress than a conference. The second such of the Marxist Center, built on top of the old Cragmore coal mines. The lecture hall is a famously conservative city, even back in the days of the 1903 Colorado labor wars, when the Springs were home to many of the mine owners. Was that weekend adorned with red flags flanking the stage and draping the walls. Delegates representing 24 local organizations, with names like Pacific Northwest Communist Labor Party, which have multiple chapters, were augmented by multiple organizations attending as observers, as well as dozens of individuals not associated with any group. This was perhaps the first time dozens of disparate socialist groups in the U.S. combined to form a national one, since at least the new communist movement of the 70s and the formation of the Communist Party from the October League. But more importantly, this is the first group formed in this way across ideological boundaries, developing its line through democratic deliberation rather than inherited positions like in the last century. What unites all these groups is not an adherence to any particular school of Marxism, but a commitment to a general strategy of base building. Base building, simply put, is organizing working people into institutions that are vehicles for struggle, collectively. This can mean challenging the rule of capitalists or industrial or tenants' unions, or it can include things like mutual aid associations and co-ops. Essentially, the aim of base building is to build a dual power to the capitalist state, creating a worker society of mass organizations that are independent of any capitalist political party. Some call this strategy dual power, while others insist on a more precise usage of the word dual power that describes a situation where working people have formed a parallel sovereignty to the capitalist state. Either way, by focusing on unity over a basic strategy instead of ideology, these groups look to carve out space outside of the dual leftist traditions of protest culture and sectarianism. Sectarianism being, we all have our own little groups, and they're all cliques, and we don't talk to each other, and we all seem to do our own organizing, stepping on each other's toes. And it's been effective. It's basically what the left has had since the 70s. Because the last time I think this was attempted, the FBI and the state, the feds, kind of came down on it. Go and told Pro, look it up. And I want to point out that whole, parallel sovereignty. So imagine for a moment, and I think this is usually a domain of right-wingers that form militias, and they're in rural areas where they hate the government so much that they basically want to create their own parallel society where, they don't want to be dependent on the government, right? And I think at the end of the day, who does? No one really does. The only reason there's any kind of need for dependency on welfare is because we're in a capitalist system where a lot of our value is taken from us. So one kind of solution / strategy is, let's say we have a neighborhood where through investment and fundraising, we build our own solar power plant so we don't need to pay utilities, water collection, gardening, set up workshops to fix or make clothes. You have a 3D printing lab so you can make little household things. And you have a bunch of kind of makerspace / homesteading stuff so that, you can make your own home goods and all that, and maybe you don't have the fanciest technology, but you can still have some hackers and hacking space stuff and and use electronic goods and whatever. And eventually, you depend on capitalist business less and less. You don't go to the grocery store. That's dual power, where you create self-sufficiency. This is where property tax actually does become onerous and rent seeking, and why do I need to pay property taxes? I'm completely self-sufficient. The only argument is that all of what you have is protected via the army, right? But let's say you organize your own militia, and it's like, okay, well, at least on a small scale, we could protect ourselves from nearby people. And the only thing we're threatened by is overseas invaders, but who are they? Why would they come over here? So here's the cultural merger formula, continuing on with this. The first night of the conference saw the largest turnout, bolstered by the college students, eager to take part in a Sorry to Bother You screening and a Q&A with filmmaker Boots Riley. In his talk, Riley emphasized the importance of a hands-on approach to class struggle. He is himself a communist, and says so in interviews. See, echoing Ellen Wood's seminal book, Retreat from Class, Riley told audience members that, except through rhetoric, the left has left behind class struggle, that organizing should take place primarily at work, where people spend the majority of their waking time, and that for the left, struggle has become an extracurricular activity. His talk illuminated aspects of the film, essentially his conception that would be called the cultural merger formula, the classical Marxist merger formula, was Kautsky's, a social theorist. But to go into Sorry to Bother You, if you've heard of this movie yet, I haven't actually seen it yet, but I know it ends with union organization. And so the crowning climax of the movie is forming a union and a call center. So his values are definitely represented there. Commenting on the Occupy movement, Riley mentioned its fetish for decentralization and its failure to congeal into a class-independent entity was in part a response to a dry and dogmatic application of professional revolutionism, as he calls it. His initial reaction to Occupy was, what the F is this shit? Because its lack of a clear independent class vision, though he also remarked that he saw people not get involved for this reason, which he views as a mistake. Perhaps a contemporary analog to this is France's Yellow Vests, Riley isn't wrong to point out that the left in recent years has been over-reliant on what he calls spectacle, though at the conference here, he was preaching to the choir. Riley reiterated the notion that you can get 50,000 people in the street to protest a war in Iraq, Vietnam, but without a labor movement shutting things down, it won't get any. Perhaps coincidentally, there seemed to be a tactical and practical unity between Riley's talk and the strategy of the overwhelming majority of base builders in attendance. Namely, this involved a desire for direct organizing. Riley mentioned that before the Longshoremen's Union was formed, the unskilled dock workers were seen as essentially unorganizable. By the mid-20th century, they were one of the most radical and militant unions in the U.S. For Riley, the entire working class can be seen as occupying the position of these unorganized dock workers. This was an important message for an audience who were themselves pushing against today's common sense that the working class is unorganizable today and is no longer a subject of social change through its own activities. One important topic that was conspicuously absent in Riley's strategy was the question of the role of the party. This ambiguity would generally carry over through the whole weekend. Marxist Center delegates and observers seemed to have a healthy skepticism of the history of endless microsects declaring themselves the party, though rather than debate the question in person, the can was kicked down the road for later. This carried over into the debate on the points of unity in the next afternoon. On to that. And he goes into the kind of minute-to-minute, I mean, it's a summary still, but of points of unity. So points of unity was like, okay, we're going to say we have all these different groups in different cities, and they're all kind of doing different things, so to speak, but they all agree that base building is what they're doing. So now if we're going to form kind of a pseudo-organization or something more national so that we can speak with a unified voice, that we can put out press statements or calls to action, that when you put out that call, then every group in it is going to follow it. That's what it means to be disciplined. Not to say, I don't know, that's not a good day for me. Like, no, if we're going on strike, we're going on strike. If it means come out and show some solidarity in public, or this is the day we're going to go out and canvas and do it all at once, to make more of a spectacle of it almost. So that's why I'm not like so down on like don't do any spectacle. I mean, got to get attention, and attention economy is what we have. Attention is currency. Social capitalism, as it can be called. Shifting away from money, since so many of us have so little money, what we can do is accumulate social capital, attention from other people. But this leads to the same kind of gamesmanship and skullduggery, you know, scamming and cheating and lying and all the bonk and bull that doing it with money. You know, we don't like it. We don't trust it. It leads to a distrust of others. So in a room of 200 communists, they had a workable points of unity. The document was unanimously accepted the next morning after a small group of a bit of drama between more authoritarian communists who think that, you know, you need a party and the party needs to be in control. It doesn't trust people to self-organize. I think I will cut this section off early. So I'll go to the last break of the show and I'll see you on the other side. This has been the Three Left Show, the middle ground between placating and depressing you. Because for most of the show, I'm talking about the kind of hard line, communist line, commie, 2 hours of communist propaganda here. And if any of it resonated with you, I'd like to know which part. If none of it resonated and it's all crazy talk, I guess I'd like to hear that too. And see what I'm doing wrong. Probably everything. So you can contact me via Twitter, Facebook, and via the pages, Three Left Show. It's three lefts. Because three lefts make right. So, an article from, get this, Business Insider, Voice of Capitalism. But they had, and this is from 20, I've had this in the bank for a long time, from basically when I was starting to think about doing this show. So it's called The 16 Best Ways to Sabotage Your Organization's Productivity from a CIA manual published in 1944. So at the height of World War II, the CIA's precursor, the Office of Strategic Services, distributed a secret pamphlet that was intended as a guidebook to citizens living in Axis nations who were sympathetic to the Allies. So people are sympathetic to a different point of view inside enemy territory, but can't put themselves at risk by, say, being out, right? And I do have this conversation with people that remain completely anonymous and nameless of I know their politics are like mine, but they do not say online or give any indication that they are as left as I am. So I'm really putting myself out there, all right? I could be scooped up. I know how scary and how the rights really don't exist and they can be taken away. But I feel it's a self-defeating narrative that if we're going to have enough people that are sympathetic, we need to be talking about what, like, let's not take half measures in our rhetoric. Let's not diffuse what we're really talking about and obfuscate. And like, well, see, I'm not really talking about socialism. I'm talking about democratic socialism. Now, of course, people who actually do that, they are talking about more welfare state and at most breaking up the banks, but then, oh, we're back to the 1980s where we had 100 big banks instead of 5. I'm not seeing how that's really helping the little guy. It's not like the little guy was doing that great then. Let's see. And the world has changed dramatically since then as well. Can't go back. So this is the Simple Sabotage Field Manual, declassified in 2008. Wow, that is a large turnover. And available on the CIA's website now, and it provides instructions for how everyday people could help the Allies weaken their country by reducing production in factories, offices, and transportation. Some of the instructions seem outdated, others remain surprisingly relevant, reads the current introduction on the CIA site. Together, they are a reminder of how easily productivity and order can be undermined. Wink, wink. By the way, as I'm reading this, let me say definitively, I am not endorsing any of this. We've collected below some of the timeless instructions on how to be a terrible employee. What's most amusing is that despite the dry language and specificity of the context, the productivity-crushing activities recommended are all too common behaviors in contemporary organizations everywhere. See if any of those listed below, quoted or abridged, remind you of your boss, colleagues, or even yourself. So in organizations and conferences, insist on doing everything through channels. Never permit shortcuts to be taken in order to expedite decisions. Make speeches. Talk as frequently as possible and at great length. Illustrate your points by long anecdotes and accounts of personal experience. I'm feeling personally attacked. When possible, refer all matters to committees for further study and consideration. All too often from our governor. Governor Cuomo in New York. Oh, man. Right now. See, we could pass New York Health, single-payer health care. But what our governor announced is that he wants to create a committee to study implementing single-payer health care. Attempt to make the committee as large as possible, never less than 5. Next, bring up irrelevant issues as frequently as possible. I've been in a lot of meetings where that happens. Haggle over precise wordings of communication, minutes, and resolutions. Oh, man. Personal experience. Occupy was hampered by a lot of this. And so there was always lots of side glance like, is this a cop doing this on purpose? Are we being punked? Are we being undermined purposely? I think so. Refer back to matters decided upon at the last meeting and attempt to reopen the question of the advisability of that decision. Next, advocate caution. Be reasonable and urge your fellow conferencees to be reasonable and avoid haste, which might result in embarrassments or difficulties later on. I think that's every mainstream Democratic consultant, or any political consultant for that matter. Blocks to being effective or solving any problems. Okay, next, as a category, managers. What can managers do to undermine productivity and destroy organizations and people power from below? In making work assignments, always sign out the unimportant jobs first. See that important jobs are assigned to inefficient workers. Next, insist on perfect work and relatively unimportant products. Send back for refinishing those that have the least flaws. Next, to lower morale and with it production, be pleasant to inefficient workers. Give them undeserved promotions. Hold conferences when there is more critical work to be done. I think in a leftist circle, that's all the time. Multiply the procedures and clearances involved in issuing instructions, paychecks, and so on. See that three people have to approve everything where one would do. So that's any kind of having any kind of executive committee. Okay, now for the bottom, employees themselves. Number one, work slowly. Number two, contrive as many interruptions to your work as you can. I think any office environment is made up of this. These are all staples of Dilbert comics. And remember, Dilbert comics take place and are from the observations of a guy who worked in the private sector. So, despite being undermined at every level and being more efficient and the free market and private enterprise being so efficient, and it's like this is how resources are best allocated. Oh, it's such bull. Okay. Do your work poorly and blame it on bad tools, machinery, or equipment. Complain that these things are preventing you from doing your job right. Gotta avoid that for myself, okay? These are old mics. We got an old sound card. Not using that as an excuse. If the audio is bad, it's because I'm not speaking close enough. I'm not speaking clear enough. Okay, gotta take responsibility. Never pass on your skill and experience to a new or less skillful worker. And that's a form of gatekeeping. And I think as a society, it holds us back so much. When it comes to base building and social activity, skill sharing is essential. And I'm always positive when instead of conferences and meetings, the things that are scheduled and delineated are webinars and lectures and like, I'm an experienced campaigner. I'm going to share some pointers with you guys. Follow suit. You know, making education kind of come first because we just need more people who know what they're doing instead of a few. And too often, the work of training new activists or advocates is slow. You know, it's like five at a time sometimes. The full manual is on the CAA's website. I'm not going there. But the link is there in the article, and I will link the article. And that was it. It was very short. Business Insider stuff is that short. But it's very interesting. I think it's very interesting. And in some of that, I could pick out of that. Like, you notice I was pausing a lot with that Marxist conference article because there was so much rambling from the two people reporting on it of the little petty details. And some of it was interesting and sort of relevant, at least to me, but I wouldn't consider it relevant to you, the listener, because it's unproductive stuff at times. Even creating a points of unity between all these groups. I mean, it builds solidarity. I think having them all in the same room or, you know, being in person, meet space, as it's called. I mean, it's always a bad sign when digital living and cyberspace takes up so much of our time that we have to make up a name for seeing someone in person, call it meet space. I'll see you in meet space, meeting people, actually meeting, which is an acknowledgement, rightfully, that when you interact with people in cyberspace, you're not actually with them or interacting with them. It's through filters. It's through all these channels. Insist on doing everything through channels, right? I'm never going to insist doing everything through Slack or some app, right? Now, there seems to be kind of a general need for it because the alternative is meeting in the same room regularly. And when it comes to doing this with activists, it's like herding cats, to use that phrase. And And meetings is not doing the work. And people want to do the work. They don't want to be in meetings. Everyone agrees. Meetings are not fun. We all hate them. If we're going to meet and discuss problem solving, we should do it in a bar or at a restaurant or do it over some social, doing some social thing. So, more social activities. I'm going to do the, and with the housekeeping again, man, this hour just goes white by. A reminder that word of mouth is the best thing you can do for your part in growing the show and the number of like-minded people. You can review this show on all the podcast platforms that we are subscribable on, your Google Play, your iTunes, your Stitcher, so on. Three Lefts is also available via your chosen social media platform, but at the moment it's Facebook and Twitter, not yet Instagram. Need to get on that, I suppose. But I just don't want to... Well, there's Hootsuite and things to manage that stuff. But you have to pay, and I don't want to pay. Want to detach myself from capitalist economy as much as possible, I tell you. To support the show more materially, visit our Patreon page and become a member there. All money is raised for outreach as a specific goal. All links and sources for the show are in the description on the show info tab and listed on our website, or at least all the episodes are found there at threelefts.news, where you can find a full backlog. So thank you very much. This has been the Three Lefts Show. Be well, stay frosty, and all that good stuff, in full solidarity with everyone out there listening here in Albany. Thank you very much. Bye.